Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did ancient travelers influence the spread of culture, food, and ideas throughout the world? And what are the modern vestiges of their intrepid wandering? As a Chinese-American running a cooking school for foreigners in Beijing, Jenlin Liu nurtured her deep interest in the food culture of her ancestors. But it was when she visited Italy that she started wondering about the links between Asian noodles and European pastas. Those questions would motivate her to undertake an exploratory journey to a number of cities along the venerable Silk Road. And as she'll tell us, the trip expanded not only her understanding of food, but of the different kinds of lives available to women along the way. Jenlin Liu's new memoir is called On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. Jen, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
You write that growing up in Southern California, the last thing you wanted was Chinese noodles or any Chinese food for that matter. How did you start to realize you wanted to embrace your heritage as you got older?
Well, I think I went through the normal processes of being a youngster growing up in a not-so-diverse part of California at that point anyways. And it was only later, I guess, when I went to the East Coast. I went to New York for college, and I just started becoming interested in my roots and my culture, and I started studying Mandarin then, and to the chagrin of my father, who was now paying for very expensive college education, and I was learning things that I could have learned back at home.
It's funny, though, that sometimes you have to make that choice on your own and feel like it's a choice rather than something you were born to.
Yes, definitely. I think it's it was something that I, you know, thankfully came to later on, and that interest in the language then became an interest in being actually a foreign correspondent in China, which is where I ended up after I graduated from college and journalism school. So I ended up being I ended up working in Beijing and Shanghai for a number of years.
And as much as you really liked that, you felt a little bit foreign living in China as well, which shouldn't surprise anyone who knows that you grew up in the United States.
Yes, yeah. And in fact, that was probably when my first real kind of identity crisis began, was, you know, having associated myself with being Chinese my whole life, I realized going to China, I actually wasn't very Chinese at all. So, you know, I mean, part of it was I didn't know the mannerisms, and I didn't know the lingo, and I was, you know, I had many foreign friends living in Beijing, and still do, actually, here in China, and so, yeah, I think as my time has grown longer in China, I feel like I can blend in more seamlessly, but I still am fundamentally American, and that has been shaped by my, you know, by where I was born and raised in the U.S.
So, Jen, I think a lot of people have heard the Marco Polo story, you know, him bringing noodles back from the East, from China, along the Silk Road. It's a fantastic story. It just turns out not to be true.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting story because that's immediately, you know, what I thought of when I went to Italy, and my husband treated me to a pasta class in Rome, and I realized that the method of making Italian fettuccine was exactly the same as Chinese noodles. And I thought, wow, is there something really to that, you know, that Marco Polo story you always hear about, but you don't really know is true. So I went back and did some research, and I found out that that story had its roots in a 1929 publication called the Macaroni Journal in the United States. And this was a publication by the U.S. Pasta Manufacturers Association, and the story was meant to spur the consumption of pasta in the U.S., which was, pasta back then was still a kind of a novelty. I mean, of course, in Italian-American communities, it was there and whatnot, but for most Americans, it was kind of, you know, as exotic as maybe Chinese food was in the 1970s or something. Hmm. So Yeah, so that story, it was in that magazine, and it was kind of this mythical, probably 500 or 600 word story about how Marco Polo ends up going to a destination that sounds really more South Pacific than Chinese, and comes across natives drying long strands of noodles. Well, it turns out in China, Chinese don't actually dry their pasta the same way Italians do.
It is funny. I guess it also speaks to how much more cosmopolitan we are today. Like, I think now lots of people might read that story and think something doesn't add up. But, you know, in 1929, a lot of Americans had not traveled anywhere.
Well, not just Americans. I mean, actually, that story has been, it was repeated to me many times on my trip from China to Italy. And, it's apparently even been incorporated into children's textbooks in Europe. It kind of goes to show the American ingenuity of our creativity and how we can, you know, we're really good at making up stories, I think, and we're really good at marketing.
So when you decided to make this trip, how did you plot out your destinations and decide where you would stop along the way?
Well, that was kind of a fun and also daunting part of the trip, of course, was all the planning that went into it. I wanted to avoid some areas that were kind of embroiled in war, like Afghanistan and, Pakistan is in war, but it's a little unstable there. So I decided to travel through China, through the northwest of China, and then through a number of stands, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. And then I went onwards through Iran, and then Turkey, and then across the Mediterranean to Italy.
Mm-hmm. One thing that becomes very clear here is that, of course, although Americans tend to think of China as sort of one place, there is there's a great amount of ethnic variety there. And although the vast percentage of the population is Han Chinese, not everyone has is part of that culture who lives in China, and not everyone sort of looks stereotypically Chinese as that would be defined by most Americans.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the real pleasures of writing this book, was that I was able to explore parts of China that don't get a whole lot of attention, and parts that have always fascinated me in the West. For example, there's a province called Qinghai that's populated by a lot of Tibetans. Tibetans aren't just in the Tibet proper of China, but they kind of spread out through other provinces as well. So I was able to go and visit Tibetan communities where they eat noodle squares there. And then I went onwards to a region called Xinjiang that is known for its Uyghur population. And Uyghurs are a Muslim ethnic minority that really look more European and Middle Eastern than Chinese. I mean, they really do look quite Western, and not what you think of as being Chinese at all.
How did people, particularly in those parts of China, react to the fact that you identified as both American and Chinese?
Well, I think for the average person on the street in anywhere in China, they, you know, identify myself. They see me and they think of me as being Chinese. So that's something that I am constantly aware of. And in those parts, I guess I was a little bit worried because the relations between Chinese and these ethnic minorities has not always been very good. And there has been some instability and some riots, and this is an ongoing problem here in China. I was worried about being kind of lumped in with being an oppressor. The hospitality, the amount of, you know, welcome, the amount of open arms that I received in these areas was quite incredible, as it was in many places along the Silk Road.
You got sick at one point and had the opportunity to visit a doctor who practiced traditional Uyghur medicine. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, the idea of traditional medicine is something that runs along the Silk Road, you know, all the way from China to Uyghur communities to, you know, Central Asia, Iran, and all the way to Italy, actually. In Chinese culture, and also Uyghur culture, they think of the body being balanced by cold and hot forces, and, you know, you might have a hotter or colder temperament yourself, and that that needs to be balanced out by certain things that you eat. And it's all about mostly foods that you ingest. So, for example, if you have a hotter temperament, you might want to eat some watermelon or yogurt to cool yourself down. Or, you know, if your body is too much in imbalance, then you might, you know, develop a cold or blisters, or, you know, it's still, to me, you know, having grown up in the West, something I can't completely wrap my head around, but you know, all of the traditional cultures along the Silk Road do believe in these things.
Well, it is, it's fascinating to think about food as medicine, because it seems that in the West, it's such a practical thing, and we don't necessarily attach so much meaning to it. And yet, you know, modern science is finding that, you know, what we eat does affect our health a lot.
Yeah, certainly, definitely. I think that we have such a divide in our heads in the West about what's medicine and what's food. And actually, it turns out that, you know, for centuries, you know, food was medicine for so many cultures. And I think, you know, as we've gotten more, you know, industrialized, or, you know, those ideas have kind of become lost.
So the other thing that you were dealing with as you went on this trip was that you had recently been married. You very much loved your husband, who is an American expatriate journalist working in China. But the idea of sort of getting used to being someone's wife was still weighing pretty heavily on you.
Yeah, I mean, I struggled with the word wife. I mean, it was funny because I didn't really have a problem with calling him my husband. But somehow being somebody's wife just seemed, you know, it took a little while to get used to after we had gotten married. And I remember, you know, him talking on the phone with somebody, you know, a month or two after we got married, and he said something about his wife. And I kind of thought, who is he talking about? Who is that person?
Did you feel like you had to become someone different, even though you had, you know, been together for a while? Was the fact that you were married, did that make things different in your relationship?
Well, I think for many women in my generation, you know, I was born in the late 70s. We haven't really had to think a lot about gender issues, I guess, growing up and, you know, in high school or college, or even for that matter, you know, in your first or second jobs. I think it really hits you later on when you are, you know, getting married, and when you think about the next step, having children, how those are the things that kind of impact you as a woman. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, not so much, I mean, of course we still have, you know, issues of not making as much money in the workforce and, you know, that sort of thing. But I think it really hit me when I got married and started thinking about children, how gender really does had an impact on my life.
My guest is writer Jen Lin Liu. Her new memoir is called On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. Welcome back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Jen Lin Liu. Her new memoir is called On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jen, were women along the way who didn't necessarily have a choice as to whether they would cook dinner for the family or eat out or ask their husbands to cook or whatever, were they surprised at how interested you were in their day-to-day lives in the kitchen?
They didn't really show their surprise if they were. I mean, more than anything, they were just so welcoming into that. It was actually, I was surprised that, you know, they were, you know, completely fine with a stranger walking into their house and asking them all kinds of questions about their lives and having them be so generous with sharing their family recipes. That was really a huge surprise for me.
And of course, they were happy to share the things that everybody in their culture really loved to eat and drink, including this thing that was the the Kyrgyzstan national beverage that you had a hard time coping with.
Yeah, kumis. It's actually a drink old enough to have been written about in Marco Polo's diaries, and basically Polo had kind of likened it to a fine wine, but I actually found it to be a little bit less palatable than that. It was kind of like a combination of moonshine and spiked with a little bit of spoiled milk. It's made from fermented mares and horses, fermented mares milk, basically, or cow's milk. Mm-hmm. And they basically let it ferment for a few days, so it, you know, slightly carbonates and becomes alcoholic, and they even feed it to babies in their country.
I was impressed by the fact, you know, so many times you read a book that's about travel and food, and it is as if the person has never tasted anything that they weren't crazy about. I like the fact that, A, you tried it and tried everything that was offered to you, and B, were candid when things just didn't quite work for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, I think there's a couple schools of thought on you know, travel writing. I mean, you know, I've heard advice that, you know, if you write about travel, it has to be good travel, and if you didn't like it, then you kind of have to lie. but I've never really felt that way. You know, I think people want to hear what it's like, whether it's good or bad, And that just adds to sort of the complexity of a place, or, you know, there's things that I didn't like about certain places, but, you know, I think I was able to find something valuable and hopefully write about places in a respectful way as well.
Mm-hmm. So on parts of the trip, your husband was with you. On many long stretches, you were by yourself. And it seems to have been a revealing thing about particular cultures, the ways that people responded, whether that was your friends back in the city who were like, is he going with you or is he not? Or people you met along the way who said, how can you be traveling without your husband? Will you talk about that?
Yeah, it was a little bit of a struggle because, well, you know, I came up with this idea to travel for 6 months, you know, not long after we got married. And, you know, I hadn't really taken into account what my husband would do with all that time. I mean, he, at that point, was also a freelance writer. So he had a lot more flexibility than most people. But, you know, I think at the same point, that doesn't necessarily mean you want to follow your spouse and sort of put aside your projects for 6 months. So, you know, it was a bit of a struggle, and I was, and also, you know, my friends and family kind of reacted in a way that I found kind of interesting, which was, you know, they wanted to know immediately. The first question when I brought up the trip was, what is Craig going to do, and, you know, what does he think about this? And at first I was a little bit surprised and somewhat annoyed because I just kind of felt like if I had been a man, you know, those questions probably wouldn't have been asked in the same way. And mm-hmm. when you read, you know, travel logs by Bill Bryson or Paul Theroux, you know, their wives are never an issue. You know, they're usually at home and kind of waiting impatiently, but they're kind of there in the background, but you know, they never really come to the forefront. But you know, it turned out to be really actually beneficial to have Craig along, first of all for his company, but also because in many of the cultures that I traveled through, from Central Asia to Iran, and even parts of Turkey, it was expected that as a married woman, I would be traveling with my husband. Mm-hmm.
You also visited places where women were expected not only to sort of be there and do whatever their husbands wanted, but they were sort of treated like servants of their own mothers-in-law.
Yes, I mean, that was a really interesting phenomenon that I've seen, that I saw across the Silk Road. I mean, and it starts in China, too. I mean, I think, you know, it actually is a tradition in Chinese culture that mother-in-laws kind of have this sort of this power over the whole family. They're you know, it's really dominated by matrons and daughter-in-laws who often have to live with, you know, the rest of the family. Everybody lives together, you know, two, three generations in a household, are often kind of just treated like they don't really belong, and that they, you know, they have to, that their role is to actually, you know, serve the family. Mm-hmm. So I saw that from China to Central Asia and parts of Iran and Turkey as well. And I mean, even in Italy, families often live together, you know, generations of family live together. And while it's maybe not as extreme there, I think those tensions still exist.
You get along, you make it clear, very well with your mother-in-law. But there was one time when you got sick and basically she was able to say, "I told you so."
Well, yes, she and my father-in-law joined Craig and me in Central Asia, and it was actually a really appropriate part of the journey for them to come along, because that was where I saw really the sort of the power of mother-in-laws and, you know, mother-in-laws who, you know, would boss their daughter-in-laws and kitchens that I cooked in and things like that. So, of course, it was completely normal for me to show up in somebody's home with not only my husband, but my in-laws with me. And, you know, I'm a bit of a more adventurous eater, of course, given what I do, than my mother-in-law. And I kind of challenged her and, you know, tried to get her to eat a little bit out of her range. But then my payback was that I ended up getting quite sick the next day.
But you never could absolutely say that it was the food.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been a bug because Craig caught something a few days later, and his father got something as well. And, you know, the only person who didn't get sick, of course, was my mother-in-law.
So what did you learn about how the practice of making bread, which seems to predate noodles everywhere and pasta everywhere, evolved into the use of dough for noodles?
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts of my noodle research, was that I discovered that Chinese noodles basically came from the tradition of bread in China. Bread is something that most Westerners don't really associate with China. But in fact, in northern China, bread has you know, a history of more than 2,000 years. And, you know, it's still very commonly eaten in the north. And it's not exactly the same kind of bread. You know, it's not European bread loaves per se, but it's more of kind of a flat bread. Mm-hmm. Anyways, this kind of bread and dough basically has been around for a long time. And the first noodles, according to historical documents, basically came from a cook one day basically taking dough from bread, you know, the dough that he was going to make bread with, and basically ripping it into little bits and boiling it in water. And the first noodles in China were called soup bread, tangbin. And the word for noodles didn't evolve until about the 6th century, didn't emerge until the 6th century AD.
And when did people start come up with the, I think, brilliant idea of filling noodles and making little pockets for pork and spices and vegetables and things like that?
You mean dumpling type noodles?
Yeah.
Those have been around since at least the 6th century AD. Dumplings, of course, are still a very popular part of Chinese cuisine. And what was interesting was all along the Silk Road, dumplings, which I think of as noodles as well. I mean, Chinese think of noodles as being much more encompassing than long, long stringy strands of dough. Anyways, dumplings, you see all across the Silk Road from China to Central Asia to Turkey and of course, in Italy, where they become tortellini.
I have to tell you, I absolutely loved reading your description of, I think it was men stretching noodles in China. It almost sounded like a ballet, and I wanted to see it on video. Can you talk a little bit about how that's done?
Yeah, it is an amazing process. Basically, it's for a dish called lamian, which is hand-pulled noodles. And they'll take basically a large hunk of dough and stretch it and make it very pliable, you know, just kind of pulling and stretching it and kind of shaking it out and twirling it and kind of folding it over itself until they get it really long and pliable, and then they're able to sort of like a series of motions that kind of resembles a child playing cat's cradle.
Mm-hmm.
They will make super long, thin strands of noodles and toss them into wok. And they're like as thin as angel hair noodles, and it's all done just by through their hands. It's amazing.
I'm always interested. I've made some homemade pasta with my daughter, and it's a lot more work than almost anything else you could do. And yet it seems that people the world over love this form of you know, processed wheat enough to keep doing it.
Well, I think that's one myth I want to dispel, is that noodle making is actually not that hard, I think.
Maybe I'm just lazy.
Well, it's just a couple more steps than making pizza, mm-hmm. which a lot of people do at home, right? If you've got the dough for pizza or bread, then basically you just need to roll it out and cut it. So it takes a little bit more arm strength and, you know, a few more minutes, but once you have it down, I can have a meal of, homemade pasta on the table in 45 minutes, including the sauce, probably.
Is there a geographic, like a clear geographic division in China of the regions that focus more on rice and the ones that focus more on noodles?
Yes. Northern China is much more focused around wheat and bread and noodles, whereas southern China has always been traditionally, their diets have been rice-based. My family originally is from southern China, so I actually grew up a lot on rice, and I didn't really have freshly made noodles, Chinese noodles, until I arrived in Beijing when I was working here after studying in college.
Another place that, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that you went to was Iran, and there are some amazing foods there, but it seems like the hospitality there was really surprisingly wonderful to you.
Oh, yeah. Iran was such a special place. I mean, especially given all the, political rhetoric between our country and Iran, we really didn't know what to expect. We were at first a little hesitant about telling people we were American. We were also amazed and surprised that we got visas to go there. And
You did not say you were journalists when you went. You were just there as tourists.
That's right. Yes. I basically said that I was a cook, mm-hmm. and I was interested in learning about the food of Iran, which was all true. Mm-hmm. And basically, the reception that we got there was, you know, just overwhelming in terms of the hospitality. And I got invited to a women's only cooking school for a week, where a mother and daughter basically took me under their wing and taught me all their elaborate rice dishes. And I was able to interact with the women at the cooking school freely. The whole time in Iran, we were actually accompanied by a government, like a minder, basically. He was, you know, officially a tour guide, but basically he told us that he sent reports about what we were doing every day to the government. So, you know, that was a bit nerve-wracking, and I was able to get away from him and go to the women's only cooking school. As a man, he wasn't able to follow me into the cooking school.
How different are women when it's just women in Iran?
I think, I think everywhere they are, you know, the same way that we are when we're women together, you know, in the U.S. I mean, that was, I had a funny experience in a Uzbek cooking school where, you know, it was all women, and this was a cooking school that prepared women for marriage. Basically, they went to the school to learn dishes that they would prepare for their husbands and families. And I taught them some Chinese cooking, and I was able to, you know, ask them about their lives, and, you know, they were just incredibly funny and, you know, sort of gossipy and, you know, a little bit lewd as well about the things they said. So, you know, I think women are like that, you know, just the way that, you know, when men get together, they can be that way. Women can too.
My guest is writer Jianlin Liu. We're talking about her new book on the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Jianlin Liu. Her new memoir is called On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So you were just talking about the cooking school in Uzbekistan. I thought your time in Kyrgyzstan was really fascinating as well. Among the things you learned was that women don't necessarily have a choice with regard to who they marry. And at times there is a sort of orchestrated kidnapping process that precedes a wedding ceremony.
Yeah, there's a tradition called bride kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan, and you know, it's not as common now as it used to be, but basically the idea would be that a suitor would pick out his potential bride, and basically his friends and family would go and find this woman and pick her up and whisk her off to a wedding that she didn't even know she was going to be a part of. And sometimes, you know, the bride is already, you know, knows the suitor, but sometimes it could be a total stranger as well.
Well, in one case, you made a friend who, you say, was impatient waiting for her beloved to abduct her.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Gulzat, is from Kyrgyzstan, and I was able to cook with her when I visited her there. And she told me that, you know, she had this boyfriend, and she was basically you know, they had been dating for a couple of years at that point, and she was really getting impatient because he still hadn't kidnapped her.
How aware are people in Central Asia of the traditions of things like Chinese cooking, and how different do you feel like the cuisine becomes once you get a certain distance away?
Well, the further you get away from China, the more alien it is. I mean, in Kyrgyzstan, you have a population of Chinese Muslims, they're called Hui. They're an ethnic minority in China. They look, you know, have the traditional features of Chinese, but have converted to Islam. They have brought a lot of Chinese dishes over to Kyrgyzstan, and so it's quite common to have Chinese restaurants there. But most people are still unfamiliar with using chopsticks and whatnot. Mm. And then once you get to Uzbekistan, their ideas of China actually are much more based in what they know of Korea, because during World War II, the Soviets brought a lot of Korean exiles over to Uzbekistan. So that's basically the East Asian influence there, and they kind of confuse Chinese and Koreans there a little bit.
And in the cities in all these countries that we in the U.S. perhaps provincially consider remote, there are still sort of foreign cuisine restaurants to be found.
Oh, you mean in Central Asia?
Yeah. Or? I mean, there are, right? You can taste cuisines of the world.
Yeah, and well, in Kyrgyzstan, there was actually, in Bishkek, the capital there, they have quite an international dining scene. Part of it is, I guess, that there has been a tradition of, they're a lot less traditional in Kyrgyzstan than they are in, say, Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan. And a lot of NGOs, for example, are based in Bishkek, and so they, you know, they've brought a lot of international organizations have done work there. So they seem to have, you know, they have, you know, burger joints that reminded me of In-N-Out. And, you know, they had Italian cuisine. And that's not something you see in every other place along the Silk Road. Interestingly enough, though, in Iran, pizza and hamburgers are huge. You know, pretty much every other store, there's a kebab shop, there's a bakery, and then there's a pizza shop, and then a hamburger stand. So, interesting.
What do you think accounts for that? Is it the fact that somehow this culture that is not necessarily celebrated still feels, because it feels forbidden, the delicacies of it are more desirable?
Yeah, I think it has to do something with that. And also there's been a long history with, you know, Iran has had a long history with the West. So before the 70s, before the revolution, there were, you know, many Western goods in Iran, and that is carried over. But I think it also adds a layer that, you know, things like McDonald's are forbidden there, and you just can't get all the Western. Though you can get Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Those two companies are very present in Iran, as they are everywhere else.
But you've had people who are like smuggling in Hershey syrup for ice cream or whatever.
Yeah, they have these stores, like kind of like general store type places where, you know, you have, revolving cases of Hershey syrup and, you know, Nutella and, Western cereals and that kind of thing.
So I thought it was fascinating that your husband blithely accompanied you to Uzbekistan and Iran and other places that aren't like high on people's list of tourist destinations. And yet Italy, he sort of felt like he could take or leave.
Well, we've been to Italy before, so that was part of it. And one of the things I write about in the book is my husband is, he would say that he enjoys food. I mean, who doesn't like food, right? But he doesn't make it a priority the same way that I do. And inevitably, when, you know, it's about me and food, he ends up spending a lot of time, you know, waiting for me. And the meals in Italy are particularly long, mm-hmm. and they usually don't start until about 8:39 at night, and they can last for 3 or 4 hours. So that was one tradition that he didn't really want to engage in.
Well, I thought it was fascinating, too, as you're sort of getting used to being married, and there's that process that we all have to go through who've been in a permanent relationship of getting to know the other person. And there was the idea of, like, who's going to cook? And he will cook if you ask him to, but it ends up not being really pleasant for either one of you. So it falls to you, and yet you therefore don't necessarily want to always have to do it.
Yeah, it was interesting because my love of cooking really developed after I moved to China and before I got married. I, you know, became a food writer and I was really interested in food. And but I had never really thought about it from the domestic angle of, you know, this is a task that women have, you know, have had forced upon them for centuries. And that idea kind of started trickling into my head after we got married, and I ended up realizing that I was spending more time in the kitchen by my choice, of course. You know, I'm more picky about the kinds of foods that I want to cook and, you know, the dishes that I want to make. And, you know, I can be kind of dominating in the kitchen. So, but then it was kind of this moment of realization, like, wait a second, why am I doing all the cooking? So, you know, it's something that we've had to work through and compromise on. And in fact, actually, Craig has shown more interest and does make amazing meals on occasion.
It is funny that we want things the way we want them. We just don't necessarily want to do them ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be the same with, you know, having children as mm-hmm. well. You know, there are certain ways that mothers want, you know, to do things with their children, and then it becomes this moment where you start feeling resentful because you think, wait a second, why am I the one doing all this stuff?
So do you see a clear line between the skills you bring to bear when you're writing about food as compared with writing about travel, or are they exactly the same? How does that work for you?
Well, I think food for me is always about travel. I mean, I always want to approach food in the context of where it's from and who's eating it and what traditions have been there for ages. I've never really wanted to be a food critic mm-hmm. Because I find the process of just writing about how something tastes, I find that actually not so interesting. I find it much more interesting to know about the background and the, you know, the things going on around the food, whether it's the history or the people cooking it and, you know, the history of the place. That to me has always been more interesting.
So for people who like this sort of thing, we should mention that the book includes a number of recipes. And I'm curious if there were things that you really loved that you wanted to include but thought no one in a sort of Western grocery store is going to be able to find the ingredients that really make this dish what it is.
Well, luckily in the U.S., we have so many, you know, foreign grocery, you know, sort of ethnic grocery stores nowadays that you can pretty much find almost everything that I found along the Silk Road. So in certain places, like for the Persian recipes, I point out, you know, certain things that you might have to get in a, you know, Persian grocery store. You might have to get phyllo dough if you want to make some of the Turkish recipes. For noodles, it's very simple, actually. All you need is all-purpose flour. Whether you're making Chinese noodles or Italian pasta, all-purpose flour works for all of them.
And what do you think it is about Italian culture that causes pastas to be, I mean, there's no word for it other than an art form. They come in 1,000 shapes, and there are people who just make pasta for a living.
Yeah, I mean, on both ends of the Silk Road, you see that in China and Italy, just this, you know, this artistry, these traditions that have been passed down from generation to generation, and hopefully they will continue in you know, the cities in Italy. You don't see that much pasta making going on with the younger people, and some of the people I met along the way in Italy are bemoaning the fact that, you know, now, you know, children don't learn how to make pasta, and, you know, you go to restaurants in Rome and they don't make pasta. They just, you know, buy it from a source. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that'll somehow change.
Are people interested in teaching their children how to cook?
In some places, no. I mean, I think in particularly places like China, for example, the head chef of my cooking school, has never wanted to teach his children how to cook because he wanted his children to go to college and get professional jobs. Hmm. So he's always thought of cooking as something that would hold them back. And I think that's true in other places along the Silk Road, too. A lot of the women, the young women I met that were my age or younger, were not interested in cooking.
Were there insights?
For the same reasons.
Were there insights that you gained about your travels and what they meant and how they had affected you that didn't become apparent until you got home and sat down to put the book together?
Oh yeah, plenty. I mean, there so much happens, and you know, it happened in the 6 month trip, and I meet so many people, and you know, the book is a real pared down version of everything, and I couldn't include all my experiences, of course. And you know, I mean, the things that I learn about marriage, you know, I'm still learning. I mean, you know, it's a continual process. I don't come to any, you know, grand conclusions about, you know, how relationships work, and either for me or for any of the women I meet along the way. As for the noodles, you know, that question, you know, I was able to look into some historical sources and whatnot, but I never found a definitive answer as to how Chinese noodles and Italian pasta are linked and where exactly the whole thing started.
Jen Lin Liu is founder of the Black Sesame Kitchen Cooking School and author of the new memoir, On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. Jen, I know it is the middle of the night where you are, and I really want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Oh, thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.